This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Hello, Stockouters. Welcome to a show that we're going to be focusing on subscription boxes. I'm Mike Bowden, still joined by Grace Sharkey. And Grace, subscription boxes is a fun topic. Are you a subscription box user? Are you a subscriber?
Yes, I am. FitFab Fun boxes I've been getting for years. Like, I almost want to say over 5 years. I used to do Birchbox back in the day, a lot of like the beauty samples. And actually, a fun story, this past weekend, I found that Meijer is starting to get its hands in kind of this whole box situation as well. So, yeah, I'm a big fan. It's a way, I feel like, to treat yourself on a monthly basis without having to like go out and shop and get a little bit of a surprise at the same time. So I'm all for it, for sure. How about you? Any subscription boxes?
I've dabbled. I'm not currently a subscriber. I used to get one that had all sorts of running material in it. Like, they would give you all these goos and running protein bars and things like that, a runner's box, but not currently subscribed to any. Certainly, they're fun. And we did a show about a year ago, where we had the one guy on who did the subscription boxes for the marijuana smoking accessories, and he's like, I can sell these in all states. Right. Not my problem if someone uses this to do something illegal in their state. That was a fun one. So we'll dig into that with Paul Jarrett, co-founder and CEO of Bulu. They're a 3PL and fulfillment provider for subscription services, specifically is how the company got started. So that'll be fun. We'll also talk about some of the topics I have here to talk about. The cocoa bean situation is not getting any better for CPG companies. The ocean shipping, market still difficult with rates, rising. I talk about that. There's really good, webinar late last week from Flexport. I can go through the highlights. There's also a really good article over the weekend from Lorianne LaRocco, our friend at CNBC, that I recommend people go read. And also talk about Nestle, activist situation there. Even though that's kind of an odd one, but I'll go through that. Before I do that, if anyone's not already signed up for the Stockout newsletter, would encourage you to go to www.freightwave.com/thestockout. And if you do that, I'll be in your inbox every Thursday or Friday or whenever the newsletter is ready. There's also a discount code to FreightWave's conference, which takes place June 4th and 5th in Atlanta. So hope to see some Stockouters there. And with that, I want to go through our first topic here, which is Nestle is being targeted by an activist investor coalition. So this one I thought was odd. I had not heard of this activist group. I guess it's not an activist fund specifically. It's a coalition of a few funds called Share Action. So it says right in the name that they're going to be an activist fund, basically. And so this represents some of the funds. Looks like it represents funds that do ESG products in Europe. And what's interesting about it is they want Nestle to have a healthier portfolio of foods. And, presumably it's because those are better investments. I would say Nestle, to a large extent, would agree with that. I mean, they've really been revamping their product portfolio. A lot of brands the last several years for Nestle have been divested. Other investments have been made. The ones that have been divested have been things like the confectionery products. Some of the investments that have been made have been things like in vitamins and healthier foods. They were looking at a stock chart with the Nestle ADR, which is how you would invest in Nestle if you were a U.S. investor. That's in black. And you see the S&P 500 in blue. And it's what's interesting. They're kind of tracking together up until about middle of last year, where a lot of the food companies underperformed last year. I think it was a lot of rotation into riskier securities. And when it became clear we were not going into a recession, anytime soon. I think a lot of the other CPG companies got caught up in that too. But I think this was interesting that we have an activist fund pushing for healthier choices, and they say that they want to urge the food giant to set a stronger target to increase the portion of its sales from healthier products amid concerns over regulatory, reputational, and legal risk to the company associated with public health and over-reliance on healthy foods. What did you think about that story? I thought it was unusual just based on, other activist actions.
Well, and like you said, I feel like they have already been focused on this as a whole. Now, what's interesting is you found that fact right that, well, at least from ShareAction's point of view, it's Nestle has 75% of its sales come from products containing high levels of salt, sugar, and fat. So I almost wonder if this is more of the label reading aspect of future generations, right? Like what's interesting is a lot of what looks like a healthier alternative out there, a lot of times you get into the actual label and start reading the ingredients and you quickly realize like high salt or one of those being the top ingredient in that product. So I wonder if this is almost more of a true honest type of breakdown when it comes to healthier alternatives, right? Like instead of just labeling and kind of, I don't want to say tricking the consumer, but a lot of, those products that we see that tend to be high, especially salt, that are seemingly healthier for you, maybe attacking a little bit more of that part of their portfolio too.
Yeah, there's definitely a disagreement of what is healthy and what is not in this situation here, where ShareAction says Nestle is getting 78% of its sales from products that are not healthy. Nestle says it's 38% are healthy, going up to 50 by the end of the decade. So some disagreement there, but it'll be interesting to watch. I think anything related to health, I think it's a big deal for CPG companies. I want to move on to the next topic here, which is a cocoa bean price update, which this situation just is not getting any better from the perspective of CPG companies. So these prices, we talked about this a few weeks ago about cocoa prices hitting all-time highs, and they continue to hit all-time highs. And so this is a chart that goes back a couple of years, and you see it's kind of up and to the right. Certainly that's measured in how's it measured? Tons of dollars per metric ton, 8,140. If we zoom out and look at a longer term chart, it's even more dramatic. Where this is, so that's a chart that goes back to 1980, and you see it's higher than it's been at any time during that period by a wide margin, and has broken through. Not only the recent trading range was sort of that 2,000 to 3,000 range, but now it's at 8,000 and higher than it was at the high in 1977. And what's also interesting is throw that onto a chart with Hershey is another one. So Hershey there is the blue line and cocoa is the black line. Now, I was just talking a minute ago about how Nestle had a bad year for its securities last year. Same thing true for Hershey, but this certainly didn't help the situation that their input costs are rising as much as they have been. Hershey's CEO, Michelle Buck, said that they would limit the input costs would limit the earnings growth this year. And what's hurting it also is that this has been going on for some time where, but last year the companies were, at least partially hedged or a little bit more hedged than they were now. Now it's been going on that it's some of the hedges have been running off. So, and then I saw Mondelez, the big company that makes chocolate, said that Europe prices are higher by 12 to 15%, versus this time last year. So before we were talking about how maybe this would start to impact prices like for Halloween candy. It seems like it's already impacting the price. I think we were too conservative when we talked about this last time.
Yeah, and if anything, affected Valentine's Day, I'm sure, a bit as well. It's talk about a reason to focus on some healthy snacks in your portfolio, right? I mean, if this stays the case, it's clearly affecting Hershey as well in that craft, in a particular way, not a good way. So Yeah, it doesn't seem, I feel like we've been talking about this for at least a couple of years now being an issue, and a lot of it being as well kind of uncontrollable in a way when it comes to weather patterns in certain growing areas too. So interesting to see if we see a little bit more of like some type of alternative in some way for the chocolate as well. But it kind of reminds me of I think it's one of the you had someone on the show before talking about like an alternative sugar. Well, it's we might need to start thinking a little bit more broader with that technology as well.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we should have we had a guest on from, I believe it was Incredo Sugar, and have a product that tricks your brain into thinking you're having more sugar than you really are. But the sugar prices have been way up too, so I'm sure they love that. But yeah, I mean, with cocoa, you've had all the bad growing conditions in West Africa for 2 years in a row. So the stockpiles are really low. And now you've had these commodities are traded and speculated on more heavily than they were in the past, including with a lot of these program traders. And so that's pushed it up. And all those things coming together, that's why we have the higher price than they've ever been. So interesting point there. Want to move on to the next topic, which is an update on the ocean, you know, talking about things that are not getting a lot better. Are sort of these, what I call the sort of the three big ocean issues, which is Red Sea situation, the water conditions in the Panama Canal, and then the ILA, you know, possible labor action. It's enough to make people nervous. I mean, I would be if I was, you know, an importer. But you have a sonar chart in there. So this is a Freightos Baltic Daily Index. The white line is China to North America West Coast. Red line is China to North America East Coast. You see, they're off a little bit from their recent highs, but still, you know, way up year to date. You know, up 100% or more year to date. Still, nothing like mid 21 or 2022. But the we learned from the Flexport webinar last week is that those prices on the ocean are high enough for the carriers to keep those vessels deployed, which is, you know, currently 88% of the Trans-Pacific capacity is deployed. That's expected to rise to 98% in April. So the Red Sea situation, you know, ends up helping the carriers. And some of those carriers are saying, well, you know, now they're really not going to have any vessels going northbound from for North America through the Red Sea. That's what CMA, CGM said. And that came after those latest casualties. I, it's hard to blame them if the crew subject to those situations. So there's that situation. And then the Panama Canal, those transits are rising from 24 vessels a day currently to 27 on March 25th. So an increase, which is good, but what's typical is 36 vessels a day. The water conditions are still low. There's not a lot of rain in the forecast. And so the kind of the bogey there is 80 feet of depth, and it's sort of sinking below 80 feet. So that's a problem. And then the ILA situation, the contract expires September 30th. There hasn't been much movement there. The local chapters have to get their issues resolved by May 17th. So there may not be any news on that until May 17th. But, you know, Flexport brings up the point that you can't just divert a vessel from those ILA worked ports to the West Coast, because those unions aren't gonna take those vessels either. So we're not going to, you know, do that to our other union, to the other unions, and there's not a lot of capacity there anyway. I mean, for some of those West Coast ports are actually having record-breaking months for imports. I mean, it's really been impressive how much importing there is right now. You know, Hapag-Lloyd, there's a quote in the CNBC article over the weekend. Hapag-Lloyd CEO, he says the inventories are low, and that's what he sort of attributed to. But there's a lot of interesting things there. I would encourage you to read Laurie Ann LaRocco's article on CNBC about that, where she actually referenced the sonar. So that made me feel good. But any additional things that you've heard on the ocean side?
You know, it's interesting. I had Lauren Began on the radio show a couple weeks ago. We brought up a number of these topics as well, including on some of the new regulations in terms of demurrage and detention too, that the ports are going to be, at least the actors in and out of the ports are going to be having to deal with too. It sounds like, I think the Panama Canal is not going to be clearly, definitely nowhere as worse as it was a couple of months ago. But I think that one isn't going to be as impactful as maybe we thought at least a few months ago would be. It does make me nervous, you're right, looking at this chart and understanding, right, like we're going to be, from what we can hope, seeing a better market turnaround here, which makes me concerned of how high those rates will come. But of course, we have to, you know, wait and see what that volume starts to look like into, the, I think, this next quarter, especially into, I think, more of the third quarter, too, and see how tight that capacity actually gets. But it, again, they also, you brought up, right, the longshoremen's, I think. Again, we have a couple of months here to see how it works out. I don't think we're going to hear much until closer to May, but I'm hoping it's nowhere near as impactful. I think of all three of the issues we touched on, that additional or that lack of capacity and additional volume could hurt us probably the most.
Yeah, it could get in a tight situation this fall for sure, this late summer fall.
Yeah.
With that, I want to bring on our today's guest, talk some subscription boxes. Our guest today is Paul Jarrett, co-founder and CEO of Bulu. They're a 3PL and fulfillment provider for subscription services. Do we have Paul? There you are.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Yeah, I'm excited to have you on because, of course, you're a part of an unplanned panel that I had at Manifest, but it ended up being very, very interesting, especially for what we cover on the show. So if you could dive into a little bit of your background and what Bulu is as well, what their offerings are.
Yeah, Michael, and for your guests, I don't know if you know, but Grace saved the day in Vegas. So she became a moderator last minute, so it was awesome. Yeah, well, thank you for asking. Thank you for having me on. Thanks, everybody out there for listening. So we started Bulu. We started as Bulu, but our first product was Bulu Box about 12 years ago. So we were one of the very first kind of rebirth of the subscription boxes. And we did that for a couple of years. And then we actually started doing it for really large brands, Disney, GNC, Crayola, you name it. We launched over 50 different subscription box programs. And then really in recent years, we've taken what we've learned mostly from logistics specifically, and we're kind of offering that to all brands now. So the way that Disney taught us to get onto retail shelves and the compliance, and the way that GNC taught us, you know, to ship to different locations, distribution centers, direct to consumers, we now do that with a few different brands, but a lot of subscription boxes at Bulu. We provide fulfillment and, you know, some consulting services, but we just kind of do it because it's too complicated to bill for consulting. So it's just a perk for our clients.
Yeah. What are some of the sort of unique challenges associated with fulfilling subscription boxes? I mean, it seems like it's just a different selection of things that change every month.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like the problem we're really focused on now is what we've always experienced, and we waited for a lot of people to fix it. We should have did it ourselves earlier, but I'd say, you know, number one, and it's not as big as a problem as it used to be, but payment systems was a big challenge, right? I would say tracking the inventory, a lot of items that go in these boxes might be handmade. They might be, you know, excess inventory. They might be not barcoded samples. And then you have expiration dates. So I'd say it's this interesting kind of challenge where a lot of the items individually are not of high value, but it doesn't mean you don't have to, you know, track your inventory and do the blocking and tackling of the logistics. And really then when you start to put them together, that's when the complication happens. And some of our boxes, we do a little, you know, you might call some light manufacturing, but we might have to assemble something kind of on the line. If it's a model kit or fly fishing lures, we might have to do a final, you know, I don't know what they even call it, spinning wire, I guess. I don't know. So I think that's the complications of a lot of those things. And really, if you do not present a great product when those customers open it up, you're over, right? The expectations are higher. You know, call it surprise and delight might be one way to do it, or just educational materials. But I think the part where it hits the customer's hands is, like, you know, just the beginning. And I think a lot of companies kind of, after you run the gauntlet of trying to put everything together, you think you're done when it's packed, but it's just getting started. And then I'd say the return logistics and the addresses, that brings another kind of wave of troubleshooting. So I always think, like, collectively, it's not complicated, but it's complex. And if you do not run very strict process, a subscription for any time period, be it a month, a year, or whatever, it is relentless, and you have to stay on top of it.
Now, one thing that I really enjoyed in terms of your energy and your comments at the conference was this outspoken enthusiasm for the subscription model for any direct-to-consumer brands.
Yes.
and even into other industries as well. Why should D2C customers focus on a subscription model or consider one within the work that they do?
Yeah, it's you're going to get me wound up, Grace. I look at the things that we missed out on when we first started, and it's a big fat facepalm with Bulu Box of just like the such basic things that we missed. And I do believe that every single e-commerce website and a lot beyond that should have some form of subscription. And that can be, you know, like a really simple paid membership where maybe you get some exclusive content or whatever it is. But I think, you know, like an apparel company, they should go white label some sort of detergent or maybe some sort of, you know, perfume. But I think everybody should look at it. And the interesting thing is, when I get behind closed doors with the folks that actually really deep dive into the e-commerce numbers, they really see this missed opportunity of subscription. And people ask me all the time, like, how did you work with Disney? How do you work with Crayola, BuzzFeed, these big, massive global brands? And really, I'll tell everybody the secret is, when you get in front of the CFO, one that would be a requirement of ours, but you really change the thinking between margin, maybe it's not as high, but it's long-term and scalable, the light bulb that would go off in the CFO's head of, oh, wow, I can start to predict the future a little bit, right? And it makes them feel safe. And as soon as we would see that in any big boardroom, you know, Disney, I remember kind of kicking underneath the desk, like the CFO got it, everybody be quiet, right? Like that was the turning point. And that's, you know, I view a subscription as a great tool that everybody should have in their box, like their kind of e-commerce toolbox. And if done correctly, maybe it's just the thing that covers like the electricity and the rent bill, right? But you really can kind of take a little bit of stress off. And, you know, frankly, for future forecasting, planning, labor, et cetera, it's nice to kind of see around the corner. So that's just a few of the things that it brings, you know, to the table if you were to do it yourself.
For sure.
Yeah. Wanted to ask you, I mean, I bet you can see into the consumer behavior like better than almost anyone. If you notice anything interesting in terms of consumer behavior, are they more willing or less willing to subscribe to something given their inflationary pressures, or just any trends you've noticed on a category level with volume in the subscription services?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, the pandemic really like flipped everything on its head. But one of the reasons why I feel like I've always said, you know, don't build your entire business off of one subscription box, because it's such a specific, highly targeted marketing device. You know, you're advertising, you're really trying to get the dollars. You're competing with Netflix, right? You're competing with subscription dollars. That was always an eye opener for us. Probably the biggest competition to subscription boxes are magazines, right? Which who pays for those, but some people do, right? And what we saw was with that Apple and Facebook policy changes, man, it was like just overnight, we saw clients just lose volume. It was brutal. It was rough, right? And so that's one thing that we've seen. And I would say people are slowly bouncing back, doing a little bit of TikTok. But it also feels like the people that really nailed the subscription box era, they're still a little bit scrambling, looking for like, how do we market this thing now? Because all of the Facebook and Apple policy changes took away from what, you know, the way that I would really simply break it down was that ability to advertise to like subscription-based purchasers, right? And once that went away, the CAC to LTV payback ratio, all the metrics kind of change the game. So I actually, and I love that, you know, I feel like I'm a true entrepreneur where amidst the chaos is opportunity, right? I was hearing about cocoa beans and I'm like, oh, this is interesting, right? Like, what can you do in that industry to make, you know, to be successful? So I like that everything got flipped on its head because it was getting to the point where, you know, the customer acquisition cost was getting, you know, probably close to 50, 60 bucks. And, you know, I love everybody just going wild on TikTok right now. And that's where I'd probably start focusing my dollars and rebuild that audience a little. I think it's a good opportunity to tweak your box and to tweak your marketing and make it stronger.
Yeah. The dangers of the TikTok shop, right? It's a consumer. I can't tell you how many those ads, they get me, that's for sure. Unfortunately, we're running out of time here. Paul, where can people go and learn more about Bulu? And of course, reach out to you to see the work that you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks again for having me on. I would say bulugroup.com. And then also, at the risk of sounding a bit narcissistic, it's just pauljarrett2rstudies.com. But yeah, if you want to get at me, you made it this far, it's just paul@bulugroup.com is my email. And yeah, I love to talk shop with anybody.
Love it. Thank you so much for coming on. And for our audience, of course, just like Mike had said, make sure that you join our newsletter. Head to freightways.com, click on newsletters at the top, join Stockout so you can get our discount code as well for our wonderful event coming up here in June in Atlanta. Until then, enjoy the show. Check out past episodes, like and subscribe, all that fun stuff, and go check out Bulu.